Okay, I have no idea what kind of phone calls we're going to get. We've got our special guest, Dr. Michael Sala. Your calls. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. How come Stephen Greer, Michael, is having so much trouble, getting more of that word out? You know, he devoted a lot of time and resources on the Disclosure Project, but it's still not happening.
Well, I think it's just the media. He hit that brick wall of the media basically shutting down. You can get a lot of people interested in the whole phenomenon, but if the general media doesn't pick it up, then it really doesn't reach beyond a kind of audience that is already interested, and you kind of, in a sense, that's that preaching to the choir phenomenon. And really, to break through that, you need to get the mass media on board, and not only Stephen Greer, I know many others that are trying to work on getting this information out. You know, many of us have been working, say, with Paul Hellyer, and even there, you can get a little bit of success, but it's only because Paul Hellyer has a certain amount of credibility, and very few people of his stature are willing to put their credibility on the line to say this is real. And because he's a Canadian, it means that the U.S. media are less interested in it.
All right, to the phones we go. Let's go first-time caller line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Yes, hello. My name is Brian, and I'm from Area 52. No, Dallas, Texas, actually.
But close, Brian.
Yeah. Well, basically, earlier Michael mentioned that there were ET rulers in ancient Egypt and also in ancient Mesopotamia. I want to know, are there any indications that there were ET rulers in ancient China? Is there anything in the ancient literature from ancient China of there being possible, god kings or, the ET god kings that Michael describes? I know he mentioned India earlier. And maybe you could also mention something about the calamity that wiped out the Indus Valley or the Indus River Valley civilization that suddenly disappeared around, I think, 1700 years ago or 1700 BC.
Well, I don't have any information on the China connection there, Brian, but certainly I know that with India that there is a lot of information about the extraterrestrial presence. India is unique in that a lot of its Vedic culture has been preserved. I mean, among all the ancient cultures, the only one that has survived is India, and with China, I know much of it was wiped out, and so we really don't know too much about those ancient myths. But certainly with India, there's a lot there, and you're quite right that there was devastation in India, suggesting that some of these advanced technologies were used in this kind of war between the gods, who in fact were different extraterrestrial groups. And I think what I would conclude is that essentially what we had were different extraterrestrial groups locating in different pockets, because when we look at the king's list from Sumeria and we look at the records of Manetho, what we have here are different records, different gods or different extraterrestrials. And similarly with India, I think we can conclude that this is a different set of extraterrestrials. So what we have here is a picture of different parts of the planet, different regions where you have these god kings who have a kind of limited role or regional control over certain populations. And certainly there were rivalries and conflicts, and Zechariah Sitchin described this in his Earth Chronicles series in terms of the wars between the gods. And I certainly know that there have been some questions about some of the these sand deposits, glass deposits in certain areas of northern India, which suggests that there was an atomic war sometime in antiquity.
Okay, thanks for your response. Next up, let's go east of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi, my name is Will. I was calling about the squirrels you were talking about earlier. Do they have anything to do with the bees that are dying too, or are they something else?
I would say that's something else. Michael, I'm not sure you're too familiar with the disappearing or dying bees.
I am familiar with it. I mean, I'm like everyone trying to guess what the phenomenon is, and at this stage I would kind of go for something like chemtrails, but I certainly am no expert on that.
Okay, very good. Let's move on to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hello there. This is Thomas calling from Pleasanton, Texas. How are y'all?
Sure, fine.
It's unreasonable to me that people would not believe in extraterrestrials if they believe in God, because by definition, would not our own God be an alien? And any of the prophets that were sent by him, they would also be aliens or extraterrestrials. And I have another comment, if you would speak of that or give your comments on one other thing, if you don't mind.
Okay, sure. We'll keep you up there.
Thank you.
Well, certainly when we look at some of the key passages in the book of Genesis, God is referred to in the plural as the Elohim, and then we see different passages, say chapter 6 from Genesis, that talks about the Nephilim mating with the daughters of Eve, and of course the book of Enoch also talking about the 200 fallen angels. Certainly then we can say that some of these gods or angels were in fact extraterrestrials. And if we were to work out exactly who the kind of supreme God is, I mean, whether it's Jehovah or some other entity, we might conclude that it may well be an extraterrestrial who was someone that was in command of the entire extraterrestrial project for Earth. So, for example, in the case of the Sumerian texts, Anu was the supreme God based on the homeworld of Nibiru, so he may be, in the Sumerian tradition, regarded as the supreme god, but he was an extraterrestrial.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, my other comment is this. I'm an amateur astronomer, and I would encourage anybody that could afford to go out and get the best telescope you can, and this is why. When you look out there and you see the vastness of space, and you understand that it takes 200 billion years for our solar system to make one revolution around the Milky Way, the first instinct is the old cliche, boy, I sure feel small. But don't look at it that way. Look out there in space and realize how big we are, because we came from that, and we are part of that. We are out there, and they are in us. So, you know, if people would look at it that way, that we are so, you know, small and you know, unimportant, that's not true. We are as large as the whole universe, however large it may be. It's all interconnected. It all relies on itself. I have a theory as to why we may be visited, and they don't want us to destroy this planet. It's because everything is in perfect balance, or needs to be in balance. And if we were to destroy this planet, literally, it could potentially throw the whole balance out and create a domino effect throughout the whole universe.
I can comment a little bit about that. I mean, one of the conceptions we have is that the universe is this vast entity, and that to travel from one part of the universe in our galaxy to another would just take enormous energy and time, and so therefore it makes the universe seem so much bigger. But if technology exists for faster-than-light speed travel, then, of course, the universe becomes much smaller. I mean, if we can, for example, instantly teleport from one part of the galaxy to the other, all of a sudden, then the galaxy and even the universe becomes kind of like our backyard. And this is something that's not so far beyond the imagination. I mean, there is an individual who's come forward that has said that he was part of an effort to develop a civilian spacecraft back in the 1950s and 1960, and that was pioneered or headed by Otis Carr, who was a protege of Nikola Tesla, and that this person who's come forward, Ralph Ring, claims that he was one of the three pilots that tested this vehicle that was being developed to travel to the moon at light speed and above, and that the belief was that you could actually travel faster than light, and this vehicle was more or less a kind of teleportation spacecraft. So Ralph Ring is actually going to be one of the speakers at our forthcoming conference here in Hawaii, and I think he's got this very important contribution to make, that civilians, even without enormous resources, can actually get together, collaborate on developing these spacecraft that are capable of faster-than-light speed travel. And he's got really amazing information, and I recommend people to go visit the conference website to find out more about him and what he's got to contribute. And certainly I think the universe, while it's big, if we develop the technology, we can really go anywhere.
Michael, are you sure there's not some kind of nefarious reason for this, for their visits?
I think that extraterrestrials have been involved in the establishment of the human presence on this planet. I think probably the reasons vary. I think some may have established humanity here as a kind of experiment to see how we would evolve Maybe some regarded us as a resource to be exploited. Some regarded us as having these incredible gifts that we could develop in a kind of hostile environment with competing extraterrestrial groups here. I think there can be many reasons. I think we really can't just conclude that that the extraterrestrial presence is something that's a threat to us. I think it's multifaceted, and it's in a sense it's kind of like the cup is half full or half empty. It's like, how do you regard this? And ultimately, I think it does become something like that, where we can look at the extraterrestrial presence. Is it something that signifies our life is half full and we should be thrilled about what that means? Or is it something that signifies the cup is half empty and we need to be worried about losing more?
Let's go to our West of the Rockies line. You're on the air with Michael Sala. Hi there.
Hi, guys. This is Bob calling you from Maui.
Yes, Bob.
Yeah, it's really a pleasure to talk to both of you. It's very interesting. I wanted to tell Michael that in the late 50s, I worked for Aerojet General in Azusa at the same time that Daniel Fry was there. And I have some additional information you might be interested in, Michael. Dan left there right around 59, if I remember right, and opened up a company in Hesperia, California, which is maybe 50 miles north of Azusa, where Aerojet was. And he started building flying saucers. And this was something that he was told, he got the information from these contacts that you had mentioned that he had while he was working at, for Aerojet in White Sands. And I had, on occasion, I would go up there and go to his plant, and I went through it, and it was really interesting. He had saucers, they were the typical flying saucer type, two pie plates, put on top of each other with a little canopy on top. And they were somewhere around 20 to 35 feet in diameter. And he had one setting out in front of the factory, kind of up on metal stilts, and the way you'd mount a fighter plane in front of a fighter, manufacturer's plant. And then inside, he had them in various stages of development. I never got to see one fly. I don't think they ever did, because Aerojet transferred me up to the Sacramento facility. And I worked for them for 16 years, and I had very high-level clearances. At the time I saw Dan's plant, I was just a very young engineer, and I didn't have too much knowledge. But then later on, I got to work on some programs that really made me an expert on that type of thing, not on flying saucers, but on spacecraft. And the reason that I became so interested in flying saucers, and this is something that I had never told anyone all the time I was working for Aerojet, because I thought they would think I was a nut and would let me go. In 1959, when I was a young man, just started working for Aerojet, I had a 56 Corvette, and I was down at the Santa Anita drag strip in Santa Anita, California, with two friends. We were racing our cars, I was on a creeper underneath my buddy's 57 Chevy working on something. As I was crawling back out, I looked up, and over the buildings in Santa Ana was a flying saucer. And I'm not kidding you, it was daylight. It was 11 o'clock in the morning. It was easy to see. And I pulled on my buddy's pant leg, and I said, "You're not going to believe what I'm looking at." They both looked at it. They both saw it. It moved very slowly for about 3 or 4 minutes across the horizon, and then it just shot straight up out of sight almost instantaneously. There was no kind of aircraft at that time that we made that could do that. So I've always believed in them. It's just like Art Bell. Once you've seen it, you never forget it. And I just thought I'd pass that along to you.
And I envy you, because I still haven't seen my very first one. What about you, Michael? Have you?
I've seen something on the Big Island of Hawaii here. I've seen some lights that certainly behave in a way that look like UFOs. I mean, they're not satellites. I mean, this is typically at night. I've seen things. Also saw some things at James Gilliland's ranch up there at Mount Adams that also pulsed, and that weren't satellites. So I know that they're definitely visiting us, but it's hard when you see lights in the sky and people are looking for the kind of daylight shot of a metallic craft, and they want more than just the light. And certainly it's something important. And Bob actually raised a really significant issue there, that is that Daniel Fry actually worked on the development of a flying saucer craft himself, because I mentioned Ralph Ring. He worked with Otis Carr, who actually went to the meetings that Daniel Fry was establishing there. He had a group called Understanding, where people discussed these advanced principles, because Daniel Fry, being a kind of aeronautical technician, he also was putting out books on the principles for the spacecraft and how the extraterrestrials who visited him, how they developed or built their craft. So he was putting this information out, and so he helped people like Otis Carr, who were developing their own plants up there at around the same time. So it's really interesting that Bob visited the plant that Daniel Fry had built up there. I'd love it if you could send me an email with your contact. I'd like to talk to you more about that and maybe get you to talk to Ralph Ring, who I'm sure would be interested to hear about that.
There's an interesting website, danielfry.com, by the way, that is pretty fascinating, Michael. Have you checked that out?
I have, and yes, he certainly is someone that experienced a really profound event with the extraterrestrials that he met with, and it really transformed his life, and he put out a lot of information to really help people understand how the extraterrestrials operated, what they were doing here, and he put out some very credible manuals on how to build your own craft, and I think people who are sufficiently gifted to develop these kinds of technologies would benefit to go to his website and check out his books on extraterrestrial propulsion systems.
Died in 1992, but man, he knew a lot when he was at White Sands. Absolutely incredible. Well, Michael, again, where do people get the book, Exopolitics?
People can go to the website, or they can just go to Amazon.com and they can find the book there.
Okay, and when we come back, we're going to continue to take your phone calls. It'll be our final segment in another very fast program. If you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com. I'll read it, and I may even get back to you. It depends on the thousands of them that just keep rolling in all the time. I take a day or two off once in a blue moon. If I don't check those emails, there's like 5,000 sitting there for me. That's what we have Tommy for. No, I do it all. Well, we're going to take final calls, but our next program, Jan Hodges joins us, a senior scientist for future technology. We're going to talk about the latest developments in Star Trek type technology. It's going to be one of those science shows on Coast to Coast AM. Do you believe there's any collusion, Michael, between other nations with regards to the UFO situation? Michael?
Yes, hi, George.
There you go. I thought you were abducted for a moment.
Well, I think there has been collusion, George, between the Soviet Union, or Russia as it's now known, and the U.S. when it comes to the possibility of the planets in our solar system holding extraterrestrial life. Both countries have sent a succession of space probes and landings to the moon, to Mars, to Venus, and all have returned data suggesting that these planets and the moon are inhospitable to life. Well, I think there has been collusion to actually hide the truth that, in fact, these planets do not prove to be inhospitable to life, that there is atmosphere on the moon, on Mars, that is sufficient, and that even the data that was given back concerning from the Mariner missions and the Venera missions to Venus, that all of this has to be called into question, given the testimony of a number of disclosure witnesses that the data concerning the possibility of life on the moon and Mars has been tampered with systematically.
Let's go back to the phones. First-time caller line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, my name is Sean. I'm calling from Eagle Mountain, Utah.
Hi, Sean. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. My question is, well, basically, I worked for one of the most major contractors for aerospace and defense technology in the world for several years, and what I've seen in my time doing that is a lot of military aircraft that would account for several UFO sightings that have happened globally. That's slightly beside the point. What my main question is, these claims of extraterrestrials being responsible for these aircraft or being the ones actually piloting these extraterrestrial so-called aircraft, and the involvement within humanity of extraterrestrials now and in the past, all these claims that I hear, such as, you know, as Michael has said, or previous callers and other times that I've heard the show, I've never seen anything ever in my life that would point to any extraterrestrial origin of anything whatsoever, yet on shows like this and elsewhere, online, magazines, books, newspapers, mm-hmm. I constantly hear these claims that, oh, extraterrestrials are regularly visiting Earth and have been for hundreds or thousands of years. My question is, where's the evidence for this?
Well, the best evidence we have are the testimonies of the people who have had these kinds of experiences, who in some cases have a very solid background, whose claims have been investigated, and so that's why people such as George Adamski, Menga, Dan Fry, the classic 1950s contactees are such important cases, because their evidence was scrutinized, very closely scrutinized for decades, and researchers have looked at the evidence, spoken to witnesses who confirm this. So as I mentioned earlier, with George Adamski, there were six witnesses to his first encounter, plus there was physical evidence, photographs, film that he provided. So this is all physical data, and I'm sure many people can cast doubt on this data. They can say, well, maybe they were hallucinating, maybe Adamski put the people up to it. But, I mean, credible researchers went and interviewed each of these witnesses in the Adamski case, and they confirmed what they saw and that Adamski wasn't hoaxing this. And then you have a number of other cases, the Billy Meyer case, many, many photos of the UFOs, other contactees are very credible, and even today we have more contactee cases. There's a breaking story in Italy at the moment with this contactee by the name of Maurizio Cavallo. Paola Harris is covering that case. She's got photographs. She's got witnesses who have seen the UFOs. So I recommend maybe getting Paola to come along and talk about.
Sure.
Talk about that case. But, I mean, there's a lot of evidence there, so I would disagree that there's nothing supporting extraterrestrial visitation.
Well, and in the old days, Michael, we did have incredible evidence of landing sites. Remember the burned-out round circles? And I have a friend, I've mentioned this story before, a reporter back in the 70s in St. Louis. He went out to Ellsbury, Missouri, covered a story of UFO sightings, saw cows walking around a burned-out circle. There was one dead cow in the middle. The others would not go in the circle. Saw thousands of dead flies scorched to the side of a tree. That's strange stuff, but it's hard evidence.
Well, that's right. I mean, anything that's left behind by extraterrestrial vehicles, I mean, that helps support these witness testimonies. And certainly there have been so many cases of that, and the Connie Zamora case from Socorro, I think it was 1964, who was a New Mexico state trooper. I mean, he, very credible person, and he saw the evidence in terms of the UFO landing, and his peers, some fellow police officers came along afterwards, and they saw the traces of the extraterrestrials that had been left behind. So definitely many other cases support that extraterrestrials do leave some evidence behind in the form of burnt grass vegetation and depressed vegetation in the area that they've landed.
Let's go west to the Rockies. Hi there.
Hi, this is Jamila from Las Vegas.
Hi.
And I am calling because I believe that my son's father was not of this world. And
oh, really? Tell us more.
Well, to me, it's just a strong feeling that I had very soon after meeting him. He almost, I don't know what to tell you except that he seemed strangely innocent and sometimes kind of shocked to be here. I knew almost nothing about UFOs. He taught me amazing things about, you know, our history of extraterrestrial contact, about UFOs. He had an incredible knowledge of metaphysics and taught me, healed me in many ways, you know, energetically, raised my consciousness. His eyes were just extremely unusual. His feet and ankles, the structure, I can't point to anything particularly and say it was, you know, that it looked unhuman, but my sense of it, it just...
Could he have been deformed?
No, it wasn't anything like that. Nothing like a clear deformation, but something just to me that seemed odd, out of place, but I couldn't...
What kind of person was he?
He was very gentle, very playful, very, very otherworldly. Very metaphysical, very, you know, had little altars to fairies around and statues of, you know, gods and goddesses. Very interested in spirituality. A very peaceful, very loving person.
I would ask, Samela, did your son or did the father display any kind of telepathic abilities or psychic abilities that stood out?
The father? Yes. Yes. In fact... I was considering moving to somewhere out, to another city without, you know, and I hadn't said anything to him about it, but I heard through a friend, he told a friend of mine that he said, oh, she's planning to move to so-and-so, and I hadn't said anything about it to either of those people. And, you know, there were several other instances that, yeah, he had an ability to telepathically gather information. Absolutely. Very psychic.
Well, I'd appreciate it if communicated later and I could get more information from you. It's a fascinating case. It reminds me of the Elizabeth Clara case. She was a South African lady who, in 1954, met with an extraterrestrial from Proxima Centauri, and they actually fell in love, and they actually did have a child. They had a son, because it was too dangerous for him to be raised here on the Earth, various governments were trying to abduct her during her pregnancy, that it was decided that the son would be raised off-planet. But certainly reminds me of that case, so I would appreciate if you contacted me, gave me your email details. Or
I'd like to see a picture of what this individual looks like. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello, gentlemen. This is James calling from Brooklyn, New York.
Hey, James.
And I have a question, I guess, from an anthropological or a mythological point of view. I was wondering if your guest knows anything about extraterrestrial mythology in ancient Swiss or Helvetian culture, and also the name of the planet that he mentioned, Corendor. There's a town in one of the southern provinces or cantons in Switzerland by the same name, although it's pronounced Corinador, and I believe that's in Valais. And I would be most interested in that because, you know, this also might have some effect on the fact that, I guess, or maybe some parallel reason why Billy Myers was contacted in Switzerland. And I wonder if you could kind of like go into that a wee bit. Thank you.
All right, thanks. What do you think of the Billy Meyer case?
Well, I think Billy Meyer is someone that is genuine. I think people who have investigated him, Wendell Stevens, Lee Elders, have looked at the case very dispassionately and objectively, and I think that they've found enough there that support Meyer being a genuine contactee. Nevertheless, Meyer, as all contactees, generates a certain group around him that becomes controversial, and I think there's a difference between the contactee and the kind of organization that's surrounded the Maya case. So I would say Maya is genuine, but the group that's formed around him may exhibit very strange behaviours. It makes it difficult for researchers to get to really speak with Billy Maya directly, rather than having to go through these filters.
Like Michael Horn, I guess, huh?
Well, ideally, you want to go directly to the source.
Sure.
And one of the things about Billy Maya, according to Wendell Stevens, is that he was someone that really wasn't in favor of any kind of hierarchy. He wasn't in favor of appointing people to special positions. He was a very humble man. And I think part of the Maya message is one of not establishing hierarchies. But inevitably, when you have an organization, you have a hierarchy, you have different people appointed to different positions, and so kind of ego comes in and the possibility of compromise and infiltration comes in. So I think these things have kind of come into the Maya case and made it difficult for researchers to really do justice to what Billy Maya has done. And for example, a lot of his contact literature still hasn't been translated into English.
Let's take some final calls. Wildcard line, it's your turn. Hi there.
Hey, George. Michael, this is Patrick calling from Virginia.
Hey, Patrick.
I'm trying to get my thoughts here together. Last week you had a female, I want to say doctor, maybe scientist, talking about space being finite, not infinite. You know, I'm drawing a blank on her name. She's very adept on the topic, and she just stated that, and one of her analogies was if you left Earth and you just traveled in one direction, this is her point about space being finite, that eventually you'd come back to Earth, you know, and she really didn't say it was a circle or anything like that, but just that, you know, our universe wasn't necessarily just going on and on. And just on that topic and then the subject you guys are talking about, you know, my idea has always been that aliens, you know, they seem to awfully human at times, two arms, two legs, things like that. That what is the possibility of, you know, extraterrestrial alien life form actually being of human nature, possibly future humans who you know mastered the time travel or some of that sort, and are, you know, literally maybe coming back and revisiting us again. And you know, I know sometimes they talk about the humans the aliens being in like their bodies by decaying or anything like that, and it just, you know, again, I just always was curious about how, you know, why aren't they just, you know, two arms, two legs, two eyes? They just seem very human-like, and I'm thinking the size of the universe and everything like that. That, you know, an alien could be anything, and so that always just brought me back to the same focus point that, you know, they could just be us in the future, I guess, visiting us and maybe looking for answers, looking for help for problems they're dealing with in the future.
There's always been that theory that they may be us, Michael, coming back.
That's right. Thanks for that question, Patrick. That does really bring us to this issue of time and how easily can time be manipulated? Can the extraterrestrials be us from the future? And I think definitely, especially when we look at some of the people who are working on the technology, the propulsion technologies of extraterrestrial vehicles, the anti-gravity in particular, often there is this relationship between the generation of electromagnetic energy and an anti-gravity pulse. And as we know from Einstein's general theory of relativity, the strength of a gravitational field does distort time-space. So in other words, if you develop the technology for space travel at above light speed, then you also have the technology for manipulating time. And so that would definitely suggest that there is a real possibility that many of these extraterrestrials, or some of them at least, are coming from the future, whether they're from our future or the future of other planets, whether it's the Pleiades or Venus or whatever, that's very much a possibility.
Next up, first-time caller line, you're up with us very quickly. Go ahead, please.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is Brandon from Shreveport, Louisiana. I was just wondering, I didn't quite hear everything you said about the Dead Scrolls earlier, but what I kind of heard was something about us not having access to all the information out of there, and I was kind of wondering who has that and what information is available and what information is contained within those scrolls.
Well, Brandon, the particular, there were a number of caves that had these scrolls that were discovered from Qumran from 1947, and the cave in particular where the least amount of information has been released is the fourth cave, and there's a particular organization in Israel, and I don't remember the exact title, but a kind of historical antiquities center that has charge of these scrolls, and they're not releasing it, and they think that the reason is quite obvious, that it threatens the mainstream religions in terms of the conventional understanding of who we are. Because we need to remember that mainstream religion has been kind of very parsimonious as to exactly what texts to include into their canon for their traditional followers. And so, for example, the Book of Enoch was excluded from the canon of the current Hebrew or Israeli biblical belief system and Christianity, and even though in the time of Jesus the Book of Enoch was regarded as one of the traditional sources. And when you look at the information in the Book of Enoch in terms of the fallen angels, the Nephilim, and 200 of them being here and being responsible for all of these problems that humanity was experiencing, then it raises this kind of extraterrestrial dimension into exactly why we are here, what the problems are humanity is experiencing, and what the future is. And that is something that I think challenges the conventional religious institutions.
His name is Dr. Michael Sala, and he's been talking about exopolitics, the alien agenda as well. Exopolitics, the book is available at 800-861-7899, or go to his website, exopolitics.org. And pick up something that will just blow your mind. Michael, thanks for being on the program, my friend.
Thank you for having me, George. I've enjoyed it again, and I look forward to the next time.
For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Ross Mitchell, Alan Corbett, Stephanie Smith, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.